So on March 7th, 1965, about 500 people showed up to march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And as you know, they were met with an onslaught of police brutality. They turned back. And as you also may know, that day became known as Bloody Sunday. So the next day, March 8th, today, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made the following statement. He said, "In the vicious maltreatment of defenseless citizens of Selma, where old women and young children were gassed and clubbed at random, we have witnessed an eruption of the disease of racism, which seeks to destroy all America. No American is without responsibility. The people of Selma will struggle on for the soul of the nation, but it is fitting that all Americans help to bear the burden. I call therefore on all clergy of all faiths to join me." So today, 50 years ago, King put out that call. No American is without responsibility. And around 2,500 people responded and drove or flew to Selma. And over 200 of them were from our tiny denomination. And one-fifth of our ministers showed up in person. What happened when this crowd of witnesses finally did cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge and march to Montgomery changed our country and our denomination forever? And we're going to talk about that next week, the march itself. But to honor this moment in our history with spiritual intention, we have to do some looking back into the past first. Because we cannot understand who we were in 1965 as a denomination and who we are today unless we look back. We have to look back at the people and the events in our history that threatened to keep us from making it to the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And we have to look back at the people and events in our religious history that led us to that march 50 years ago. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great 20th century religious leader and civil rights advocate, you may know that Heschel was on that march, linked arm in arm with Dr. King, walking and walking for days to Montgomery. And you may recall how Rabbi Heschel said he realized that he was praying with his legs. He was following the ideals of his Jewish faith that were laid out in front of him, one step at a time. No matter the religious tradition, faith walks out in front of us, showing us the way. It's no different for us Unitarian Universalists. We're also no different from people of other religious traditions in that we don't always live up to the calling of our faith. It's always there, inspiring us to do the right thing, the compassionate thing. Yet many Unitarian Universalists before us looked away and stood in place, refusing to walk in the difficult but right direction. We all lose heart and are afraid from time to time, afraid to pray with our legs, to walk in the difficult but right direction. And that's okay. That's one reason that we belong to a faith community, to hold one another while we dust ourselves off each week, to try again and again, to live in alignment with our spiritual convictions. We come here trying to refocus, to see the ideal way of living, of treating one another, and the world around us more clearly. We come together to remind each other how our faith is walking out ahead of us to show us the way, 1 week, 1 day, 1 hour at a time. You may or may not know that before 1961, Unitarianism and Universalism were two separate denominations. And after a vote in 1959 and a lot of work, in 1961 we merged. So if I'm referring to an event before 1961, you might hear me refer only to the Unitarians or the Universalists. So belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all people and a commitment to social justice are present in many of the written documents in Unitarian and Universalism throughout history. Living up to the words we put down on paper and built our denomination on has taken much longer. From the 1800s, at least through the 1940s, the American Unitarian Association worked hard to discourage African Americans from becoming Unitarian ministers. There were a few African American men who were eventually granted fellowship by the American Unitarian Association, and one of them was Reverend Egbert Ethelred Brown, who you'll hear me preach about at length at another time. But Brown was born in Jamaica, and he was just doing religious reading on his own and discovered the ideas of Unitarianism and had an intense conversion experience. And he established a Unitarian community there in Jamaica, but then committing his life to the faith, he moved to the US to continue his ministerial training. And the American Unitarian Association could not approve of Reverend Brown serving a white congregation. They told him, "We will let you be a minister if you can find an African American congregation to serve." So Reverend Brown successfully started an African American Unitarian congregation in Harlem. And every time Reverend Brown asked for support of any kind from the AUA, they denied him. In fact, at every turn, the AUA questioned his competence and his ability to minister to his congregation. There are a collection of degrading, racist remarks made by the Unitarian leadership of that time, back and forth in their letters about Reverend Brown. And in the end, as you might imagine, the congregation collapsed and disbanded. In the first half of the 20th century, there were many stories of African-American Unitarians in Chicago, Cincinnati, Boston, including graduates of Harvard Divinity School, being denied fellowship into our ministry based on the color of their skin. In 1889, the Universalist denomination ordained Joseph Jordan, the first African-American ever welcomed into their ministry. And Jordan brought Universalism to the black community in Norfolk, Virginia, in the form of children's schools that were based in Universalist values. And most Universalists supported these schools, but there was one, John Van Skyke, who happened to be the editor of a national Universalist publication, who spoke openly about his belief in the superiority of the white race and his opposition to having these Universalist mission schools. Unitarian Universalist historian Mark Morrison Reed says, "Under Van Skyke's influence, Universalism's theology proclaiming openness and the oneness of the human family was muddled and twisted." This story always hurts me to tell because I loved her so much. She's done so much. But women's suffrage activists, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, were Unitarians. They did a lot of wonderful things. But in the 1860s, the anti-slavery movement and the women's rights movement attempted to join forces, and they eventually did, successfully. But Cady Stanton and Anthony fought hard to keep this alliance from happening. Stanton, in particular, emphasized her belief in the superiority of whites in a number of her speeches. And Stanton rejected the support that social reformer and former slave Frederick Douglass offered repeatedly. He was ready to join, to align with the women's rights movement. But Stanton responded by making it publicly clear that she opposed the 14th Amendment, which, among other things, would grant citizenship to ex-slaves. In Black Pioneers in a White Denomination, Mark Morrison Reed notes the minutes of a number of board meetings from our congregations in the 50s and 60s. And the minutes reveal conversations that twist and warp our commitment to freedom of thought and freedom of conscience. These minutes reveal an argument that occurred fairly frequently, that freedom of thought and conscience includes the right to support racial segregation. More recently, at the 1993 General Assembly, that's when all Unitarian Universalists gather in one city to go through all the relevant business in our denomination. In 1993, this meeting was held in Charlotte, North Carolina, and one of the events promoted by the organizers, all were white, was we'll have a Thomas Jefferson-themed ball and come in a period costume, whatever you would have worn in Thomas Jefferson's time. And a number of, one Native American and a number of African American ministers and UUs came forward and said, "I'm really sorry, but I left my rags and my chains at home. Can't do it." These are the moments in our religious history when Unitarian Universalists have looked away and stood in place, refusing to walk in the difficult but right direction. The direction that our faith is always calling us. These are the moments that threaten to keep us from marching at the Edmund Pettus Bridge 50 years ago. And of course, in all these stories I have told thus far, people were a product of the society they were living in. Of course, this kind of white supremacist thinking and action was to be expected in the 19th century. Even subconsciously thinking that white culture and history are the only culture in history was not uncommon in the 90s or today. And I always understand the historical context argument, I really do, but it was still wrong. And each of these failures to see the humanity, the worth and dignity that runs deeper than the color of our skin was a moment in our religious history of standing still, of being too angry or afraid to walk in the right direction. And I don't tell these stories to drive us to despair. I tell these stories to tell the truth about our religious history, the melding of events that add up to the present. I also tell these stories so that when we hear about all the ways that Unitarian and Universalists walked boldly in the direction of our faith, when we hear those stories, we'll remember it wasn't easy for them. It wasn't without opposition and complexity and deep collective soul searching. If we are going to keep walking boldly together, we need to remember that it won't be easy or straightforward. There was no easy journey behind the stories that I'm about to tell. I wish that Reverend Egbert Ethelred Brown and other Black Unitarian ministers could be here today. In contrast to the 1800s and early 1900s, today, Unitarian Universalist ministers, in order to receive your professional credentials, you have to demonstrate through study and action that you are committed to anti-oppression, anti-racism, and promoting multiculturalism in our religion. Despite opposition within our denomination, you cannot study the abolition movement, that's the anti-slavery movement in the United States, without learning many Unitarian and Universalist names. Unitarian Lydia Maria Child in 1833 published a book called An Appeal in Favor of That Class of Americans Called Africans, which became the most influential anti-slavery nonfiction book ever written. When Universalist leader John Van Skyke was publishing his white supremacist opinions in a national publication, other Universalists were writing editorials in response. Universalist minister Clarence Skinner wrote in the paper in 1944, "Our religion must be the radical cure to racism. It gets down to the root of which prejudice grows. It digs into the soil of man's selfishness, superstition, and distortion. Our faith destroys the vicious partialism which would lock us into divisive cells of race, denying us the common rights of humanity. We must enlarge the borders of our consciousness to include the human race." Reverend John Haynes Holmes was the minister of Community Unitarian Church in New York City. He worked hard to integrate his congregation in a time when other Unitarian congregations were still trying to make up their mind. Reverend Holmes was also a co-founder of the NAACP and a co-founder of the American Civil Liberties Union. Unitarian minister James Luther Adams recalled a board meeting in his congregation in the 1940s when the congregation was trying to decide whether or not to integrate. And the meeting went late into the night, and there were passionate discussions from either side. And early in the hours of the morning, one board member blurted out to this one member who had been particularly stubborn, saying, "No, we can't integrate." His fellow board member said to him, "What do you think the purpose of the church is?" And without thinking, that man said, "To change people like me." And in January 1948, they integrated. In the 1860s, Unitarians Julia Ward Howe and Mary Livermore publicly denounced Elizabeth Cady Stanton's racism and stood by both abolition and the women's suffrage movement. Reflecting on her own activism later in life, Universalist Clara Barton said, "If the door was not wide enough for all at once, and one must wait, or all must wait, then I for one was willing that the scarred slave go through before me." Happily, Frederick Douglass was not completely turned off by his interactions with Unitarianism. He attended All Souls Unitarian Church in Washington, D.C., and later All Souls Church in Chicago. So it must have been very hard for him to be there. But in 1893, Douglass approached the Unitarian minister in Chicago and said, "I have been here more often than I meant to be, but I could not stay away. You are standing for a great and holy ideal. My brother, keep the standard as ever so high as now, and the world will come to it by and by." There have been so many moments when, despite opposition, fear, and anger, prejudice in our own denomination, Unitarian and Universalists have walked in the difficult but right direction in pursuit of that great and holy ideal that our faith holds out in front of us. It is this mixture of moral disappointments and compassionate victories that come together to form the place we stand in now as a faith. We are here each week to hold one another while we dust ourselves off and try again and again and again to live by our spiritual convictions. We come together to remind each other how our faith is walking out ahead of us to show us the way one week, one day, one hour at a time. And I hope you'll come back next week to hear the rest of the story. Blessed be. Amen. And as we prepare to sing this final hymn, I do want us to take a moment. There's too much to say, couldn't get to the march itself today. But I want us to picture the thousands of people in Alabama today who will be marching over the bridge at 2:30. And let's think of all those people 50 years ago who came together risking their own safety to show their commitment to our shared humanity. And let's sing in honor of all of them, "We Shall Overcome," which is number 169 in your hymnal.